Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. Thank you very much for coming. Before I begin, let me do our usual housekeeping notes. First of all, everybody, please turn off your cell phones. We've all chatted about this, or at least mute them. We've just done this at the head table. We do put all of these up on YouTube, and it really interferes with the sound quality if somebody beeps right as somebody's trying to do listen for a quote. And a lot of people do now watch our speeches on YouTube and complain if they can't get the correct quote if they're still stuck at their desks. Second of all, let me tell you about a couple of upcoming events we have. We still have a few seats left for Professor Charlie Jeffrey tomorrow, here from the University of Edinburgh. He's a scholar on, among other issues, the whole question of whether Scotland will seek independence again, and a lot of interpretation of what really happened on the referendum in September. So if you'd like to go to that, we have a few seats left. It's almost full, however. And then coming up next week on the 17th, we have Last Days in Vietnam, a film by Rory Kennedy. This is using a lot of footage that hasn't been seen before, describing just what happened as the Americans left Vietnam in the last days there in 75. We will have the executive producer, Mark Sammels, by Skype from the States. So this has just come out. You can't see it anywhere else here. So with that, let me introduce our guest for today. Patrick Lowe, as many of you know, was the longtime chief economist of the World Trade Organization. He has been a voice, in many ways, the voice of the World Trade Organization through its entire history, almost its entire history. He is now at the Fung Global Institute. Terrific person to call. I called him on Monday when I was doing a story on the APEC trade deals, South Korea and China, now it looks like China and Australia as well. And he just immediately had a great, insightful comment. And when I got back the edited version from my editors, on Tuesday morning from my editors in New York, there was a note by his comment saying, great quote. So he really knows how to distill the issues, and we're looking forward with all the trade news we've had from APEC to his distilling the issues for us today. Thank you.
Can I put this down? Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. After that introduction, I'm quite sure I can only disappoint. So I better do it in style. It's good to see some familiar faces here. And I'm going to talk today about international trade cooperation. And my basic premise is that it's in flux and in trouble. Its future is uncertain. And the lack of effective cooperation in the trade field is potentially destabilizing. It squeezes growth. And it contributes to political tension. I think what's happened in the last few days in Beijing has got more positive than negative news, but I would argue that we're not out of the woods by any stretch of the imagination. I'm going to indulge myself, and I'm not sure you, by doing a bit of history first. I want to put this all in its context, because for me, part of the bottom line of all this story is what's happened to multilateralism, what's happened to a basic fundamental notion of a non-discriminatory world of trade and investment. And I think the news is pretty dismal, and the problem it creates is pretty large. So that's around what I'm talking about. So let me just give you a little bit of history. I think the first 50 years of the 20th century were, we might even say, a disgrace to global governance. There wasn't any global governance. We had wars, we had disastrous economic management, a notable absence of any attempt at serious cooperation among nations. So the creation of the Bretton Woods institutions was a big deal. It was a departure, it was important, and the whole structure that was created with the UN, with Bretton Woods, with GATT, warts and all, has served the world pretty well in the 20th century. But modernization is knocking at the door. The challenge of adjustment is proving to be huge. And I would suggest so far not terribly well met. So let me just go back to the, I'm going to focus on the trade part of that story. So the GATT. The GATT started in 1948 with 23 countries who wanted to clean up all the mess of the Second World War and of the recession and all the trade policy nastiness that went on in the context of that recession immediately prior to the war. And for 4 or 5 decades, I think it did a fine job. But it was amongst a small group of countries who were unquestionably, undeniably in charge. Over time, decolonization, the first big hurdle for this cozy club was incorporating Japan. And they did it very ungracefully and very badly in the mid-50s. After that, increasing number of members, the 23 came to well over 100 before the GATT transformed itself into the WTO. Increasingly diverse, and development issues coming to the fore. Much, much harder to get simple agreements around shared priorities. A big change for GATT when the WTO came along, a serious attempt to modernize the regime, to bring in services, to bring in intellectual property, to change the whole way that disputes were settled. And from the mid-1980s, the major challenge which the WTO faces today, apart from its own internal difficulties, has been the growth of regionalism, the growth of preferentialism in trade. There are over 200, I mean, we lost count, frankly, of how many of these agreements exist, these preferential trade agreements. Each WTO member, of whom there are 160 today, on average belongs to 13 separate preferential trade agreements. Now, you can't tell me that's a good way to do business. It's not rocket science to suggest that this is highly inefficient. It introduces all sorts of frictions, tensions, uncertainties, and transactions costs. So that's where we are. Why did that happen? Well, partly it was the beginning in the early 80s, the beginning of the demise of American hegemony. The US itself started to make preferential trade agreements, which it hadn't been doing before. There were defensive reasons for doing this. As more and more countries got involved in this game, spheres of influence became really important. The exercise of localized power rather than global power. Avoiding exclusion was a motive for getting into some of these things. An insurance policy that if things got nasty, maybe if you had a preferential arrangement, you would be the last to suffer. And offensive reasons. The WTO is not going fast enough. The WTO is talking about the wrong things. The WTO needs to modernize. We need deeper integration. So let's shake off the shackles and go preferential. And then, of course, it became increasingly an instrument of politics. At its worst, we used to refer to it as the CNN effect. Due respect to CNN, you just want to get the minister in the newspaper so you sign one of these agreements. Well, all these things have coalesced around this explosion. And now let's go to the 21st century. The 21st century, the WTO was still in reasonable shape. It launched the Doha round of trade negotiations. This was an ambitious round, maybe too ambitious. The ambition was partly felt by the aftershock of 9/11. This happened very soon after 9/11. And it was also when China joined the WTO in 2001. And that changed the WTO and the world forever. So the 21st century is a very big story, and I think we haven't quite digested it yet. The explosion of growth in the emerging economies and the post-Lehman acceleration of the tendencies that this created towards a shift of power towards the East is very much at the heart of what is troubling not just the WTO, but a lot of the competition that we see through these regional preferential arrangements. And the big development of the last few years, and this is a very recent phenomenon, is what we refer to as the mega-regionals. The mega-regionals are the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, and the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. Now so you're probably familiar with these. The TPP is 12 countries between the United States and some other countries that side of the Atlantic, and 6 or 7 countries this side. RCEP is basically a pan-Asian group. It's 10 ASEAN countries plus 6 others. And TTIP, of course, is just the EU and the US, and they're really talking regulation above everything else. So you've got these three groups, and a lot of people were discussing how these three groups were formed, what they were trying to do, whether they were compatible, to what extent were they rivalrous, to what extent were they driven by geopolitics. And I think they were all of the above. But then another creature of partial integration made its appearance in the form of the Free Trade for the Americas, FTAAP, Free Trade for the America and Americas and the Pacific. And this was an old idea. This had actually been driven by APEC, and there had been an agreement in principle to do something along these lines in 2006. But then it kind of fell moribund. And then the Chinese resurrected it in the context of their chairmanship of APEC. Around April last year, they said, why don't we do this? And of course, that got pushback, particularly from the United States, because they were concerned about the TPP and what effect it would have on getting the TPP done. But of course, China in its turn was concerned about the TPP too, because at least part of it was arguably a ring-fencing exercise. So, you know, in that environment, which I say in many ways is driven by this shift in power relationships and a rebooting of the realities of the world economy, including, by the way, the modernization created by technology and globalization and the whole global value chain world, has created a situation in which we are I would argue, some difficulty. Now, if you think about what's gone wrong with the WTO, well, the lack of leadership. There's no longer one nation primarily that's running it, that's setting the pace. It's torn by geopolitics, just as arguably as the regional agreements are. It has arcane working methods, and it's got an outdated mandate. It's working on 20th century issues in the 21st century. And until that gets fixed, it's hard to see how the WTO is going to come together. The final nail in the coffin, arguably, well, I hope not, but arguably of the Doha round was in July when India refused to go forward with an agreement that had been struck the previous December in Bali. So I think that scene has created the situation that we're in now. The WTO centrality is really to be questioned, at least for the time being. But I think that is, as I said earlier, I think that is that really a source of our difficulties. The alternative of trying to manage international trade relations and, I guess, to some extent, investment relations through these mega regionals seems to me to be deeply unattractive for a variety of reasons. One is that they tend to entrench discrimination. I mean, TPP, when it comes about, will actually hurt the trade of some of the countries that are not part of it. That would be the same with RCEP, and of course it would be the same with TTIP. I think that these agreements tend to generate more economic and political friction than you would get if you were at least trying to do business in a multilateral environment. I think they truncate economic opportunities precisely because of their discriminatory nature. And I think one of the worst things about them, and one of the things that I think we should worry more about and don't really know enough about, is that they sow the seeds of regulatory divergence, which will be very hard to reverse if everyone decides to go back to the mothership and do business in a more multilateral environment. And today, you know, when you think about trade policy, you think about what affects trade flows, we used to worry, I mean, part of the success of the GATT was precisely that it managed to get rid of all these tariffs, and tariffs were the cutting edge of protection. Tariffs now are a much less significant part of the story. A lot of this is to do with regulation, and it's to do with what we call behind the border things. Now, that's the raw material of these preferential agreements, these mega regionals. If they get entrenched, how are we going to get back? You see this in microcosm. Let's take the example of the EU and the US, the things that they disagree about. I don't think they're ever going to agree on them, and I'm not sure they should be trying that hard. It's things like GMOs, genetically modified organisms, very different attitudes. Culture, ethics get mixed up, and so we've got to stop thinking of this stuff in terms of trade. We've got to think of it in much deeper, much more far-reaching terms, and in development terms too. One of the attractions of RCEP, for example, and of course this is very relevant for what the Chinese announced in Beijing about the Silk Road developments, is that if you want to open up the markets for trade, you should enable those markets to participate in trade. It shouldn't be just you open them up so that you can get in there and have a good time. And so it's the whole thing has become just a lot more complex. And the more you do this, the more you do these things in these geographically rivalrous entities, I think the harder it's going to be to get the big picture again. So that's what worries me. I think the APEC meetings have been positive, but I think, for example, in this business of the tension between FTAAP and TPP, I think they've just papered the cracks. There are still these issues still have to be resolved. But there might, the atmospherics were great, apart from the coat incident. The atmospherics were pretty good. So I think that's how long is it going to last, and is it going to be anything durable from it? My final thought, so I've tried to be brief. My final thought is, you know, some people say, you know, you're fussing about nothing. You know, this crisis mongering. Well, is it really so bad? I mean, look, trade takes place, foreign investment takes place. Why are you worried? Let it go. It doesn't really matter. It keeps a few bureaucrats and politicians in business, but actually, where the real things happen on the factory floor and where business actually has to function, business deals with it. Business manages it. So what's all the fuss? Well, I think that, of course, I have a vested interest in saying, you can say, well, of course they'll say that, he's an old bureaucrat. But honestly, I do believe that if you take that view, we don't need pre-commitment in policy behavior internationally, that we don't need the stability-enhancing features of international agreements, then maybe you should look a bit more closely at history. I think it's short-sighted. You know, it's like not worrying about the termites. Termites in the wooden structure of your house. The rot is imperceptible, it's silent, it's gradual, but it's ultimately fatal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, why don't we go straight to a question about looking at two of the mega regionals. Does FTAAP pose less of a threat because everybody's guessing that it might be almost more superficial, it won't try to liberalize trade in the areas that get really tough? Or is TPP, but on the other hand, it involves a lot of countries, or is TPP a bigger threat to global trade in the sense that it could produce a really deep agreement with a lot of trade dismantling, but that might create by itself a trade bloc the way NAFTA or the EU has? Which do you think is both more potential but also more of a disruption of global commerce to the extent it produces a trade bloc?
Well, I think that an agreement like FTAAP involving more countries and a wider array of interests and a less obvious source of political authority would probably be a lighter agreement. But I want to know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. If we look at TPP, it depends who you talk to as whether you think this is deep integration or not. Because if you look at the 20th century issues covered by TPP, if you look at, let's say, the agreement on reducing tariffs, this is being done in a very strange way. The 12 countries are having bilateral agreements, right? Now, normally, when you used to do that in the GATT, you'd have a bilateral discussion with your major suppliers, and you would cut a deal about what you would do and what you'd do for each other, and then you'd multilateralize it, and everyone else in the agreement, in the GATT WTO, would get the same treatment, and it would be a non-discriminatory. What's happening in TPP is that there's an end date promise, and because they do these things in secret, we don't quite know what that end date is. People have been talking about 20 years for making these reductions applicable to the entire membership of TPP. So it's discriminatory within itself in an area where you would have thought that we had gotten past this basic instrument of trade policy protection. So when you look at some of it, you'll say, well, this is actually distinctly 20th century. It's not deep integration. But when you look at other things, you say, well, indeed it is. And then you say, well, what are these other things, and are we happy with them? And you've got things like the ability of companies to take governments to court on the altar of an international agreement, and that some countries, including Australia in this case, get very nervous about that. And you get some deep questions about intellectual property rights, for example. Now, I'm the last one to say we don't need intellectual property rights and that we don't need them internationally. But there is such a thing as overprotection of intellectual property, which is actually does what it, the reverse of what it's supposed to do. If you protect patents too vigorously, you will reduce the level of research and development. So I think you've got to take a more nuanced approach to thinking about this. And I think there's a lot of politics in this, a lot of power in this. The power relationships determine outcomes. So I think FTAAP will be lighter for that reason. But I would focus on what I think of the real advantages of these kinds of cooperative agreements. You might not get as far as you want in opening one another's markets, but at least you've got a conversation. At least you've got pre-commitment. At least you've got accountability. And I think that's a lot better than having nothing. And I think those things tend to be durable. They'll be much slower. A lot of people look at ASEAN and say, wow, those guys really taking their time. But when you think about what the counterfactual might be amongst this complex group of countries with deeply diverse cultures, all these different languages, and you say, well, actually, they've got it together. We should think about the counterfactual before we be too fussy about how quickly they're moving.
He's being very polite. I was the one saying ASEAN is sure taking a long time. With that, but I guess you can say that they have gotten something done. So who would like to ask the next question? Please identify yourselves, please. And wait for the mic. Sorry.
Robert Greaves, Hamilton Advisors. Thank you, Patrick. Insightful as always. I think you're talking about something that I want to focus on a little bit. And correct me if I'm wrong, but really at the base of this is economic nationalism. And economic nationalism has been ascribed to China, but it's probably also as bad in the U.S. And I'd like to ask you, is economic nationalism now, in this stage of the 21st century, worse than ever before, and does it have different characteristics?
Well, I'm not enough of a historian to say if it's worse than it ever has been before. It's certainly present and correct, but I think it's more than just economic nationalism. I'm not enough of a historian to know whether it's the worst episode of nationalism. I mean, clearly nationalism is emerging in all sorts of forms. I think it's not just economic nationalism. I think it's there's a lot of power that isn't immediately relevant to economics, at least, that is in play. For so many years, we were able to rely on one country to write the rules. And for a long time, and I don't want to sound overly complacent about this, but for a long time there seemed to be a pretty broad consensus that this was a good way for proceeding. But that fell apart. Inevitably, it was going to fall apart as power was rebalanced. So the tensions that creates are really the tensions that we're seeing now. And some of them we've seen in the Asian region in terms of territory, geography, and a lot of the stuff about trade and investment relationships. So I think, if somebody said, well, what would you do? I would follow the example of, there's a recent book by the Peterson Institute in Washington. The Peterson Institute some of you will know Fred Bergston. So his new thing, he was very keen on FTAAP. Now his new thing is, why don't we just cut through all this and get the United States and China to negotiate their own agreement. Just do it. Put it all on the table. Sit down face to face with the objective of cutting a deal. For me, that would make a huge difference, because one of our afflictions in reality is that when these guys don't agree, the negative spillovers on the rest of the world are enormous and growing. And so for the longer they keep this up, the worse it gets for everybody else. And the sad part of it is, and this will sound really trite, but it's like the difference between thinking it's a zero-sum game and thinking it's a positive-sum game. If you think it's a zero-sum game, you're just fighting over a fixed quantum of whatever it is. It's like the size of the pie. It's how big is my slice compared to yours. But if you recognize that through cooperation you can actually increase the size of the pie, that's the positive sum story, then there's everything to play for and every reason to cooperate. And that's terribly simple, terribly trite, but really important.
Tara.
Really interesting. It just leads to the question of, is Europe really that irrelevant? I mean, it is a huge trade zone. I understand that importance of the U.S.-China relationship, but Europe is a power player, surely.
I knew it was going to come.
A true writer's question.
I knew we were going to get this. And in fact, we're preparing for next week, right? We're going to the same conference organized by the Germans in Vietnam. I'll say that I think they make great ringmasters. I think Europe isn't in a very strong place right now in terms of being able to exert any kind of authority outside of its borders. Why? It's got no growth. And two, the whole European experiment is under question. So I think it's still big, it's still important, but I don't see any convincing leadership coming out of any structure that we could call pan-European right now. They're going to be upset with that, aren't they?
Okay. Well, I would have a follow-up, but let's please take from the floor.
Over here, please.
Hi, I'm Janelle O from the Australian Consulate. I'm kind of interested in your elegy for the WTO.
Funeral elegy?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of talk about the final nail in its coffin, and that's sort of the only context in which you discussed the WTO. I mean, I agree that the WTO is in a lot of trouble. How would you bring it into the 21st century? I mean, a lot of these mega trade agreements, as you indicated, are in part a response to frustration with lack of progress in the WTO. The Doha round was supposed to create incentives for developing countries to engage. That doesn't seem to have worked. How do you transform the WTO into something relevant to the 21st century and make multilateralism more attractive?
In 3 minutes, we've got four more questions.
Actually, the thing about I really don't like dissing the WTO because that's been my life. But I do have to say that if the WTO doesn't change its working methods, it's going to just jump from crisis to crisis. There are rumours now that the difficulty with the Indians might be eased and we might actually get on with the trade facilitation agreement, but it's going to just be a matter of time before the next one pops up. And why is that? Because the decision-making process in the WTO is deeply dysfunctional. It's too easy to turn the principle of consensus into a veto. And it's too easy to cross-condition your veto on something that has absolutely nothing to do with what's on the table and say, well, unless you agree with what I want, I'm going to say no. So there are two ways you can deal with this. One way is to raise the costs of veto, and that would be a procedural arrangement whereby you'd have to go through certain hoops in order to exercise that veto in terms of the numbers of people you could get on side to make to support you, in terms of the rationale you gave, in terms of disallowing this kind of cross-conditional hostage-taking. There are things you could do. Or you do what I think will be the destruction of the WTO, which is to allow to write discrimination into it in a way that would be ultimately make it no better than any of the mega-regionals. And I really hope it doesn't come to that. But so the first thing is decision-making. The second thing is the agenda. Now, you can't get the agenda fixed unless you can get people actually talking to one another. And it seems that the atmosphere in Geneva is pretty poison right now, and it's really hard to see how they're going to talk to each other. And I think one of the other things in Geneva is that there's this bubble, the Geneva bubble. It's kind of removed from reality. They've lost sight of who they are, who they're supposed to be serving, and what they're supposed to be doing. And so you get all sorts of things happening which actually don't really seem to have much to do with the real world. So if you can fix that too. And it's interesting, isn't it, that the mega-regionals especially, and regionals in general, preferential agreements in general, you get much higher political engagement in national capitals than you do in the WTO. And so in a complex world where you don't just have to deal with a trade ministry and perhaps a finance ministry, you have to deal with a whole range of ministries,
because there are all sorts of regulations involved, there are all sorts of things involved. The huge coordination problem at the national level is not attended to in the WTO. So it basically gives free season to whoever's in your representing your government. Now, this is not true of everyone, but it doesn't have to be true of very many before you have stasis. And I think so my answer is, if only we can get proper leadership, and that would mean shared leadership in the WTO, then you can start to prevent those kinds of things from getting out of hand. Otherwise, I don't see where the future is for the WTO.
Okay, over here, so we get from variety of...
You had mentioned that you felt that the US and China should negotiate their own trade agreement. We can probably understand why that would be beneficial in many ways. Are there any things about that you would feel would be not beneficial to the rest of the world, or a downside that would make other countries nervous about that?
There are always these risks, aren't there, that when the big guys get together, I mean, if you ask many countries that are members of the GATT WTO, they would say that's why the WTO has got to where it is, because right. until relatively recently, until the 21st century, all it took was that the Europeans and the Americans agree, and by one way or another, that would become the reality, it would happen. And people said, well, that was unfair, that was unrepresentative. So power is always going to be there, it's a question of how you manage it, and I completely agree with you. If this were ever to happen, if this idea were to pass the laugh test, it would have to be hedged around, really hedged around, with accountability. And that is the problem with the mega regionals. They're all done in secret.
Eliminate China and give other countries an advantage over China, in a sense?
Yeah.
TPP, in a sense, is in somewhat aimed
well, many people say that there's yeah, many people say there's an
so
element
subtly.
That there's an element of geopolitics which imagines that China can be ring-fenced, part of the pivot. But of course there's denial about that.
Right.
But I think the reality is that these are competing agreements. They are competing arrangements. I mean, why is it the United States and China are not in any don't have any agreements in common?
Yeah.
Back in the corner, please.
Hi, Tanya Nefi from CLSA. Just continuing with that theme, the U.S.-China potential trade talks. What would you identify as the single most important concession that both of those countries would have to make, US and China, to really make an agreement anyway realistic?
Wow. Am I allowed to say I don't know? Thank you. That's a hard question. It would be like a fishing expedition. It's just an idea.
Up here, please.
Michael Beer from Citi. With increased interregional trade in Asia, can ASEAN begin to negotiate as a true community once the AEC comes into effect later next year, or will it continue to be this disparate collection of nations, each negotiating with China independently?
And I have a friend in the ASEAN Secretariat who assures me, I don't know if it's wishful thinking, assures me that things will move, and they will be in a different place in 2015 from the place they are now. Now, I really don't have an inside track on that. I don't know how true it is. But I think one of the things that is challenging for RCEP is that it's based on the concept of ASEAN centrality. Now, ASEAN centrality means that ASEAN leads. And for ASEAN to lead, Indonesia has to get in there, because Indonesia is a very big player in the ASEAN grouping. Is that going to happen? It's early days to know what the answer to that is. But I think that until ASEAN is more integrated, the idea of ASEAN centrality and ASEAN leadership will slow things down somewhat.
Over here, since you've had the hand the longest, you're next.
So going back to, you referred to, you know, the complexity of these agreements and then the idea that perhaps even how much they matter with real trade. I've seen numbers about India that despite the preferential agreements that it is a part of, that just a very small fraction of its trade is taking advantage of those preferences. I haven't seen those numbers for, you know, some of the other economies, but to ask you, I mean, how much of a disconnect is there between actual trade and these pacts and where you see things going?
Well, I think there's a sort of prior question. What is the level of India's trade in relation to the size of its economy? It's really small. because they've chosen policies which have focused more on domestic markets than they have on foreign markets. I think that if you look at the you look at India's tariff profile, India has above average tariffs compared to many other countries. But when the tariffs that India faces in its export markets may not really be a particularly significant determinant of trade flows, but if they were more trade oriented, then some of the other things that impede trade might become more noticeable in terms of the direction of the flow. And I don't know whether those things would correlate well or not with the agreements that they're involved in. It depends a little on the content.
Nick Edwards from the South China Morning Post. If APEC was living up to what it was meant to deliver by 2020, wouldn't all the talk about FTAAP by 2025 be rather redundant and pointless anyway, because there'd have been free trade delivered? And also thinking about what you were saying about political tensions through all of these agreements, I mean, if global value chains were better understood and everybody understood what the contribution to trade was, would there be less of a political tension to need these rival agreements in the first place?
I think on to the first question, you're absolutely right. I mean, that target was set in 1994, and 2020 looked an awful long way away. Now it's getting closer, and obviously what was envisaged in 1994 won't necessarily or will not come to fruition in 2020. So yeah, I think a lot of the conversation we're having today would be less pronounced if that had happened. But it's not just about the things that the Bogor Declaration was aimed at, was, you know, essentially free trade, which was really the old idea of just get rid of the tariff barriers and the border barriers at the border. The deep integration thing makes it more difficult. So to answer the second question about the GVCs, I think yes. I think if there was a greater awareness of the interdependency between imports and exports and how much your success in economic growth turned on both your treatment of imports and your treatment of exports, you'd go quite a lot of the way, but you'd still have this lump and mass of regulatory raw material that you'd have to work with in order to try to understand to what extent people are willing to give, people are willing to accept. I mean, one of the things that is becoming clearer, I think, and you really see it in the TTIP negotiations, although they're not directly about this region, is that there are issues on the table, which, and as I mentioned when I was speaking, that are really not to do with trade. They're really not to do with specialization and the advantages of efficiency. They're to do with how you want your society to look and how you want people to behave and what you think is acceptable and unacceptable. And so it goes to things that you may not really need to or shouldn't maybe want to, subject to the winds of unfettered competition across frontiers. So there's always going to be that part of the story which it may be a fool's errand to try to fix, and it certainly creates tension and pushback. And to some extent that's happening in TPP. I was saying to Keith over lunch that, you know, I'm not a great proponent of agricultural protectionism, but I don't believe either that agriculture is just like anything else.
Over here, we had one more.
Sorry, could you, before I get into my question, can you clarify the FTAP actually stands for the Free Trade Agreement in the Asia-Pacific and not Americas and Pacific?
Yeah, FTAP would be the 21 members of APEC,
right?
Which include the North Americans, several of the Latin Americans, and a lot of Asia, not all of it.
My understanding was that the FTAP was basically China's ploy to sort of get the Asia-Pacific region on, rather than focusing on getting the Americas on board. But in any case, my question really is, much of this discussion about, you know, the TPP and the FTAP being direct competitors, isn't the real threat from FTAP towards the RCEP? Because that, you know, basically sort of pits, a vast number of Asian countries to sort of choose between one or the other, rather than the TPP, which basically only has three Asian countries.
No, the TPP has six or seven, I can't remember which it is, Asian countries.
Right.
Some of those countries are also in RCEP. These things are so overlapping. I don't know if it would be a threat to RCEP. I mean, it depends who you think is actually truly leading RCEP and whether or not there'd be a confluence of interest within the RCEP region with the idea of doing this transatlantically as well. I hadn't really thought of the, of RCEP as being a victim. I think, you know, the United States wanted to finish TPP before they even talked about FTAP. But the United States, like everyone else in APEC, have committed to the idea that this is where to go next. So I think a lot depends on, you know, so they've got this two-year breathing space because there's going to be a study on FTAP, which is a study which is to explore what's at stake. And so in those 2 years, one expects to see TPP finished or failed, one of the two. You expect to see RCEP progressing, maybe. You would expect to see whatever's going to happen in AEC, although AEC, I must say, they've hedged their bets. They say 2015, but we'll still be a work in progress. So I don't know. I think the world in 20... Things move so fast. The world in 2016, I don't know who will feel more uncomfortable in terms of these different groupings about the prospect of actually doing something in FTAP. I'm not sure.
Two-minute question. George, our guest has a flight, so we're going to wrap up here.
I don't know enough about the legal structure of WTO, but if members of WTO sign these other agreements, does that in some way contradict their obligations under WTO? So if you sign enough of these agreements, does it eventually just sort of nullify WTO?
Is this an innocent question?
Yes.
Because that is at the nub of much of what has been troubling the WTO in terms of its ability to manage international trade, that you have this rash of preferential agreements, which of course are discriminatory, and there's a provision in there which is supposed to set some rules for how you manage them, so that they're basically least trade restrictive possible, not introducing new discrimination. So the idea is that they'll create trade, but they won't divert trade. I mean, that's basically the idea. But almost no agreement has ever received consensus blessing in the GATT or WTO. So there's been a basic understanding amongst the membership that these things in and of themselves are not going to be that harmful to the idea of the WTO as the centerpiece of international trade cooperation. And it's that idea that's been upset in recent years.
Have you seen any of them that have actually raised trade barriers to non-members of the trading bloc, which would be the main hurdle to cross? Or have all of them so far been... I mean, you can still get trade diversion if you lower trade barriers within your trade bloc, but of course it's worse if you raise them against everybody else. Have you seen any of that?
I'm sure there is, but it's really hard to detect because of these things called the rules of origin. Mm-hmm. The rules of origin are custom made for every single product line. And unless they happen to be, there's different kinds of rules of origin, but a lot of them are based on mechanisms which essentially determine the conditions of competition between insiders and outsiders at every product level. And so there's no doubt that some of these are discriminatory and exclusive and reduce opportunities that existed before the establishment of the agreement. But by and large, there seems to be a view that until relatively recently, these agreements were not intended to be discriminatory. They weren't set up in order to exclude others. They were simply attempts to advance an agenda that was of particular interest to the parties concerned. That was the kind of, you might say that was a bit complacent, and there were people who said we shouldn't take that argument too far, but at the same time we've got to recognize that we live in a world where there's going to be these preferential agreements aren't going to just go away. They've taken three decades to build and they're going to stay there, but they're not so, you know, they're not so toxic. We can work with them and we can help to. And the more of them there are, in a sense, one of the arguments was the more of them there are, the less the preferences that you're actually going to get from them will be, and eventually it'll all come home to roost as a multilateral collection. Okay.
But thank you very much. I spoke to Patrick as he was taking the train in from Kuala Lumpur Airport to downtown Kuala Lumpur on Monday afternoon. I said, boy, I sure hope you're still coming to lunch. It sounds like you're going the wrong direction. I'm glad you came back. We like to give our guests something to remember the club by. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.